This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Recently, the United Methodist Church tried unsuccessfully to put an ad on one of the most famous billboards in the world, the 28-floor, 7,000-square-foot television screen on the side of the Reuters building in New York City's Times Square. Some may wonder why a church needs a $21 million advertising campaign to spread the word. Well, if you haven't noticed, there's been a change in the way some churches operate. Surveys show that more Americans have switched from the faith they were raised in and gone shopping for new denominations, even new religions, and many churches are looking for ways to bring them into their pews. In an effort to woo these potential worshipers, many churches have de-emphasized the fire and brimstone rhetoric of the past. In some churches, PowerPoint presentations accompany sermons. In others, hip-hop and rock music have replaced traditional hymns. But is the effort to please diluting the doctrine? And how is the competition changing churches? Have you switched from one church to another? Why? Has your church, synagogue, or house of worship gone to compete for new members? And has that message changed along the way? We'd be interested to hear also from ministers, rabbis, and priests. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Alan Wolfe. He's the director of the Boissy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College, the author of a new book called The Transformation of American Religion, How We Actually Live Our Faith. He's with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
What is this transformation of American religion you're writing about?
Oh, you did a terrific summary of the book. Thanks. It's about the fact that the image that a lot of people have, especially non-religious people have, of faith as filled with fire and brimstone and damnation and pointing the finger of sin and blame at those who've done wrong, a dark and brooding Jonathan Edwards, sinners in the hands of God, of an angry God church. That's been radically transformed in the United States into something that's more consumer-friendly. The pews have been taken out of a lot of mega churches, and comfortable chairs have been put in. I mean, for me, that symbolizes the idea. It's we want to get people into church. We don't want to insist on a message that's going to drive them away.
And to get them into church, at least what you're saying, is they're not asking for an awful lot of sacrifice.
They're not asking for an awful lot of religion, as far as I can tell. Some of the mega churches, which are, of course, Christian, don't put on a cross to display. They fear that a cross will kind of turn people off. Well, when I was doing the research for my book, I talked to a wonderful couple in Cincinnati. He founded a church there, one of the largest churches, one of the 25 largest churches in the country. And his wife was taking me through the building, and we kind of went through the lobby, which looked like a Radisson Hotel, and we passed the franchise operations that work in the lobby. And then we went into the sanctuary.
Excuse me, franchise operations?
Well, you know, you can get books in some churches, not in this one. Some churches you can get McDonald's or Starbucks or whatever. My point, though, is in this particular one, we went into the sanctuary. And, you know, when you go into a sanctuary, there's kind of a hush. And there was a hush, but the hush was because she wanted to tell me that they don't call it a sanctuary. Sanctuary is a word, she said, that will turn people off. And so it's more of a kind of reception room. And I think that that also kind of conveys the sense of what's going on in a lot of America's megachurches.
We do hear an awful lot, and you're talking at the moment about these megachurches are Christian evangelical churches, but we also hear a lot about the more fundamentalist churches where, you know, the fire and brimstone may not have gone out of fashion.
There are some. Certainly, I would never want to downplay that, especially in the South and certain denominations, the Southern Baptist Convention in particular. There is more of an emphasis on the old fire and damnation message. You can certainly see that on the television shows that kind of feature many of these churches. But even there, when I listen to the sermons, what I hear is that when you've sinned, it's not that you've offended against God, which is the classical definition of sin, mm-hmm. but that you're hurting yourself. And so there is a recovery dimension, a therapeutic dimension, even in some of the most fundamentalist of American churches.
So God isn't necessarily your judge, but your buddy.
We live in a non-judgmental culture, and yes, God is someone, as one best-selling book, I wish my book was such a best-selling book, put it, you can have a conversation with God, and people do. People ask God for a lot of things. They want a God who's warm and appreciative, who empowers them, who makes them feel better, who gives them a certain amount of self-confidence. And the God of America, American religion, definitely does all those things.
Now, one of the statistics that you write about in your book is the degree to which people are willing to change from the church in which they were raised, that traditional structure, the faith of our fathers, if you will, and go shopping, if you will, for something new.
That's been a dramatic change just over the course of the last 50 years. Seekers, people who are going to find a faith that works for them. Sociologists have a kind of fancy language for it. They talked about the difference between a status that's ascribed to you, that's kind of written down, and you just follow the script, versus a status that you achieve through your own efforts. And religion is much more moved from the category of something that's ascribed to something that we achieve. It's dramatic, actually, and it affects all of America's religions.
So not just Protestants that we've been talking largely about.
Protestants, I think, are in some ways the most likely to switch, because the whole emphasis in Protestantism is a kind of individualistic emphasis. Martin Luther, of course, the great leader of the Protestant Reformation, talked about a priesthood of all believers. And if you think that ultimately religious authority lies with the individual rather than with a clergy or rather than with a tradition, of course there's going to be more switching there, because the emphasis is on the individual. But one of the themes of my book is that in some ways we're all evangelicals now. We're all people that are looking for a warm personal relationship with God. And while evangelicals will call that God Jesus and Jews won't, that personal dimension is what really links them together.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Alan Wolfe, whose new book is called The Transformation of American Religion, How We Actually Live Our Faith. And let's go with Jennifer, who is with us on the line from Wichita, Kansas.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say we're actually switching from a more of a newer type church, actually back to a traditional church.
Why?
Because with the newer type church, we don't feel that it's giving us the kind of spirituality or getting as much in touch with our spiritual beliefs as the new church does.
Why did you, you're talking about a newer type church, is that what you were raised in?
No, actually we were raised more traditionally.
Uh-huh. And why did you switch in the first place?
We actually hadn't been going to church.
I see.
And then we decided to, this is the way our children need to be raised. So we chose a church, and it's more of the newer with the more poppy, more pop-style music and PowerPoint presentations. And I just can't get in touch with that. So, I just feel the message or getting in touch with the spirituality wasn't being achieved through that. It was more of a commercial type, we have to do this, or, push more of the image as opposed to the message.
Alan Wolfe, Jennifer is moving back to something more traditional.
It's a very interesting comment she's making. I personally am not religious. I'm fascinated by religion, and I very much wanted to get involved in the world of religion to write about it, but I don't hear the religious voices in me. But if I were religious, I would agree very much with Jennifer. I would want organ music. I would want strong, powerful sermons. I wouldn't want Microsoft PowerPoint kinds of presentations, which try to simplify everything down into two or three categories. By God, I'd want the old-time religion. But that's easier for me to say, because I'm not in there in church on Sundays. But I certainly appreciate what she's saying.
Jennifer, one of the things that people talk about in the attraction of these new-style churches is the sense of community, the being around people who are like you. Did that happen for you?
Actually, no. We don't feel as comfortable, so we're actually going to a new church, but it has more people we know and more of a community than this one. And I don't know if it's just because the church we've previously been going to was more appealing to a younger audience, more like early 20s, no kids, as opposed to early 30s with kids. So maybe it's just the way I was raised,
mm-hmm.
or maybe it's just, you know, the generation gap. I'm not sure about that one.
Well, Jennifer,
but I just wasn't comfortable with it. So
thanks very much for the call, and good luck.
Thank you.
And we're going to be talking more about the different ways that various churches are trying to attract the unchurched, if you will, or even the churched into their pews. And we're going to listen to a clip now of a United Methodist Church radio commercial.
I believe we make life harder than it's supposed to be.
I believe God talks to us every day if we listen.
I believe too much television is bad for our children.
I believe we have an obligation to leave the world better than we found it.
I can't believe there's a church that believes these things.
We may not all believe exactly the same thing, but the people of the United Methodist Church believe in God and each other. If you're searching for something to believe in, our hearts, our minds, and our doors are always open. The people of the United Methodist Church.
A radio commercial for the United Methodist Church, and we don't mean to pick on the Methodists in particular. It was just the audio that we could get a hold of. But Alan Wolfe, this kind of advertising, is this new?
When I was a kid, there was a song that goes, "I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows." You may remember it as well, which was a kind of soft approach to religion as well. So in some ways, it's not new. I think that there is a fundamental problem, if you want, or challenge perhaps, that faces America's religions, and especially the evangelical variety, but all religions really. And that is, if you believe that you have something that's valuable, something that will help people, is your obligation to get that message out to as many people as you possibly can, even if in our culture, which is a short attention span culture, you have to drop some of the doctrine and some of the theology that goes with it? Or do you want to insist on the truth, insist on the theology, but do so in a way that's really going to turn people off? That's a very, very difficult dilemma. And I think that I can understand why churches will resolve that dilemma in favor of, let's get them in. Sure, it's advertising and we don't like advertising. Sure, it looks like the free market and we don't like that either. But, you know, it's better to get them in and then try to reach them than to keep them out. But there's no doubt that we pay a price for that. One thing the commercial didn't talk about is I believe in God. Simple, straightforward, I believe in God.
There is also, though, you say, an upside to all of this.
Well, I think there certainly is an upside. It's an incredibly dynamic society we live in. It's a society in which everything's always changing. You watch television, and you know, there's the shows are always changing. You watch football, and they're going from using instant replay to not instant replay. You watch politics, and the tactics are always shifting. Why should religion be any different? You can't isolate religion from the rest of the culture. You can't pretend that the culture is going to be competitive and dynamic and organized by the free market, and then religion is somehow going to be stuffy and put in the closet. It just doesn't work that way. I think a lot of religious leaders would in some ways want it to be, because they want to treat religion as somehow holier and different than these secular things. But religion in America has become in many ways a secular thing to the extent that it's been integrated into the culture.
Briefly, you also say that this could also lead to more tolerance.
I think definitely leads to more tolerance. It's a funny process how it does. We have this, as you pointed out, Neil, you know, we have all this religious switching. It's no longer that your parents' and grandparents' religion is going to be yours. Now, if you've adopted a different religion, and if your children might even adopt one different than yours, and in fact, if the one you've adopted now might not be the one that you're going to have 5 years down the road, you better not say anything too nasty about any of the other religions, because you may be condemning to burn in hell yourself 5 years from now. So I think that one of the byproducts of this religious switching is, you know, the downside is that it thins out everything. But the positive side is that it does give more tolerance, and that's important. You know, people die over faith,
mm-hmm.
but not so much in the United States.
We're talking with author Alan Wolfe about what how he thinks the competition for congregants is creating a new kind of church or churches. Join us, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about why Americans are changing churches much more often than they used to, and about how the competition for congregants is creating a new kind of church. Our guest is Alan Wolfe, the author of The Transformation of American Religion, How We Actually Live Our Faith. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Melissa, who's in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Afternoon.
I just wanted to make a comment. I was raised Mormon, and my husband was raised Catholic, and I was definitely turned off at a very young age from this fire and brimstone kind of ideology. And as I got my education, my undergraduate work, I began to study religion, and I started to notice the commonalities in doctrine between all of the major religions and studied in that way. And now we take our children to several different institutions, different temples, churches, and all feeling the same sort of spiritual experience. We've tried to join all of these together, and it's actually increased the tolerance in our family, and it's really become a very positive experience for me as an adult.
Is part of this experience, I wonder, Melissa, though, looking for the one that might really appeal to you?
Well, we haven't yet found something, a church in our area, that would really address all of these doctrines and pull them together as where they would apply to our lives. So basically, we just sort of go from one to another. For example, we went to meditation classes at a Buddhist temple, and we'll go to certain significant ceremonies based on our friends that go to these certain churches. But we haven't yet found one specific religion that will pull all of these together.
Well, Alan Wolfe, you talk about people shopping for religion. Melissa seems to be on the extreme edge of that.
Well, yeah, I think her story is a very, very interesting one, and it certainly confirms a lot of what I find in my research. I hear her saying, and I hope I'm not putting words into her mouth, that you can almost make a distinction between faith, which is something that people really like and appreciate, and religion, which is another matter entirely. For a lot of Americans, religion is about denominations, and it's about conflict, and it's about buildings, and it's about squabbles, whereas faith is something that should transcend all of those things. And people really want to put their faith in faith. And they feel that religions that exclude people, or religions that say that our message is true and all other messages are false, are somehow not being honest with the faithfulness that Americans feel. And that's why so many Americans want to keep open the option of experiencing different kinds of faith.
Does that sound right, Melissa?
Yeah, exactly. I rejected the idea of having one true religion based on the society that we live in. And there are so many connections to be drawn between all of these different things. They're basically saying the same thing in a different way.
Well, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Joining us now is Eddie Gibbs. He's a professor of church growth in the School of Intercultural Studies at the Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California. He's also the author of Church Next, Quantum Changes in How We Do Ministry. He's with us from the studios of member station KPCC in Pasadena, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, Neil.
I wonder what you think of this new trend.
Well, I find myself in broad agreement with a lot that Alan is saying. Clearly, people are in a switching mood and moving in very different directions, some from more liberal to more conservative, others from conservative to more liberal. I do, however, think that there is a significant generational distinction in that the mega churches that were referred to were attractive largely to the returning boomer generation. That's those born between 1964 and 1946. And those churches experienced significant growth until the mid-90s. But there is a new trend afoot that we need to be aware of. And this is reflected in boomers who are, some of them, walking away from the kind of churches that have been described. And younger people, the 20-somethings particularly, who are very suspicious of celebrative religion and are very concerned for a deep spirituality, for a religion that's a seven-day-a-week religion, not a one-hour-every-7-days kind of religion. And they're also connecting with ancient Christian traditions. So I think we must be aware that there is a new move afoot.
What do you think about that, Alan Wolfe? Are there distinct age differences?
Yes, there very much are. In fact, one of your listeners was, one of your callers was talking about this. It's almost as if you have a segmented market out there, and you have churches for people with very young children. You have churches for people with no children. You have churches for people whose children have left home. The people will approach religion differently at different points in the life cycle. Protestants, Jews, Catholics will all do this to some degree or another. And I certainly agree with Eddie Gibbs that, especially among younger people, there is a kind of post-megachurch phenomenon. I talk in my book about how megachurches, which have been all the rage in the discussion about religion, I think that they've peaked to a considerable degree. You will be seeing a return to a more quote-unquote traditional kind of religion among younger people. Now, the reason why I put quotes around it is because even though it's a turn to orthodoxy and a turn to tradition, it's still being driven by the same forces. It's still an individual decision. It's still a decision based upon, I have a need that has to be filled. And it's not an inherited religion the way, traditional religion usually is. It's a it's a chosen tradition, so to speak.
All right. Let's get another caller in. Doug is on the line from Rochester, Minnesota.
Michigan.
Michigan. I always think Minnesota because I think of the Mayo Clinic. Excuse me.
I'm first-time caller. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was raised Catholic, a pretty large Catholic family, and when I was 18, I got introduced to a non-denominational church that had a lot of strong Baptist roots, and I actually ended up getting baptized when I was 18 in that church. And one of the things that was especially helpful to me is that it was boiled down and it was relevant, because it wasn't a lot of dogma. It was relevant actually to a day-to-day basis. Here's how you're living your life. Here's what the Bible says. It's interesting you mentioned trying to have more pop culture elements. I actually performed in the church, and the first service we did two Kiss songs in full Kiss Army gear. On stage for all these, and it that seems kind of silly, but it got a lot of people in from the streets interested in church and interested in learning about the Bible. So it was a pretty interesting experience for me, being raised in a pretty strict Catholic faith.
Having been raised in a strict Catholic faith, as you were getting out there in full Kiss gear, I mean, was there a moment of trepidation that, maybe lightning bolts may come down?
Yeah, the last thing you'd expect to see in church is somebody like that. It was interesting because I actually invited my parents, and my dad actually mentioned that he learned more in an hour being in that church than in 15 years of, being in a Catholic church. So it was... It was interesting because I was able to sort of, it's kind of hard to force that sort of thing on somebody with traditional Catholic. You can't sit down with someone and force it upon them. It's better for them to sort of see it. And my parents participated, and they thought it was interesting.
Eddie Gibbs, let me bring you in here. Yes. What Doug's talking about, what you might define as a postmodern church?
Yes, indeed. I think that... a church must be rooted in a cultural context that has been true throughout history. Excuse me. In fact, one of the problems faced by traditional denominations is that the culture which gave rise to those denominations now no longer exists in the form that it did. And so they're having real problems communicating in a multicultural post-Christendom kind of environment. But if we go back to the early church, and as it had to translate into the Greco-Roman world of the first century, it had to reinvent itself as a movement then. Around the world, the church will look very different in various cultural contexts. So we mustn't be surprised with the pluralism of American society and the mobility that we find here, that the church takes on very different expressions that's appropriate to each cultural context.
Thanks very much for the call, Doug.
Thank you.
Okay. Alan Wolfe, I wanted to ask you, part of every church's mission is to spread the word, isn't it? I mean, where do you draw the line between, passing on the word and evangelizing and marketing?
Well, first, it's not really true that every church is obligated to spread the word. Jews have not been an evangelical faith compared to Christians, and different churches within the Christian world, different denominations, will attach different importance to evangelization. Evangelicals, obviously, from the term, from the name itself, which is Greek for the good news of the gospel that we're all expected to share. I mean, evangelicals are the most committed to spreading the word. They're under a great commission to do so, and they do so with great energy. I think that the fact that evangelicals evangelize is a fact of enormous significance for the shape of American religion. In the worlds I live, which tend to be secular worlds of once Jewish intellectuals like me, there's a great fear of evangelicals. In Manhattan and in Boston and Brooklyn, there's a sense that evangelicals are intolerant, that they're hostile to modernity, that they're out there simply trying to impose their view of sin and damnation on people who don't share it. And so they're fearful of the whole idea. What I try to show in my book is that there are reasons to be worried about evangelicals, but they're not that reason. The very fact that evangelicals have to engage the culture in order to spread the word is in many ways a Faustian pact that evangelicals have made with the culture. The determination to spread the word means that you have to engage the society. And when you engage the society, you lose all the rough edges. So I don't see an intolerant, hostile to modernity form of evangelicalism. I see an evangelicalism that has more in common with NASCAR and Oprah Winfrey than it does with the Scopes trial, something that's become so much part of the emotional, almost anti-intellectual culture of the United States that it really doesn't constitute a viable alternative to it.
Eddie Gibbs, how important is the cultural package in all of this?
Well, let me say to Alan that I'm an evangelical. I hope I don't scare you.
No, I've been in your class at Fuller, and I thought you were a terrific teacher, and written about you in the Atlantic Monthly and elsewhere.
I was just teasing. Well, I think that, again, part of our problem within the broad spread of evangelicalism, it is a broad spread, is that so many pastors within the evangelical tradition have had no missionary training, regrettably. And that means that they don't talk mission, they talk marketing, and it means that we are not very good at engaging respectfully those of other faiths. So that there is a lot of truth in what Alan is saying. Now, speaking from my own context at Fuller in the School of Intercultural Studies, that our focus is very much on critical contextualization, with the realization that in every culture, including our own, there are aspects that the good news of Jesus Christ brings fulfillment. There are aspects on which it will pass judgment. And so that the requirement is for discernment to distinguish between aspects of culture that the gospel affirms and those aspects where we do identify the demonic. Now, we've spoken about fire and brimstone. I wouldn't use that language, but I think that the issue of sin has to be addressed. And in relation to not only hurting of oneself, and sin does that, but also in terms of offending God, because personalized evil is something that we have to address more effectively, I think, within our society.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And let's get back to the phones. And Jeremy is with us from St. Helens in Oregon.
Hi. I was calling because I am not a Christian, but I seem to have lots of friends who are, and every single one of them is trying to get me to attend their churches and telling me why theirs is better than the next. And one interesting thing happened is I had two different friends sitting at the kitchen table, and they started debating about how their churches were better than the next person's. And I was kind of curious. It got me to thinking, for a Christian pastor, where do they get their authority and their training? And I know in a Catholic priest, you know, reports all the way up to the Pope, but for a Christian pastor, who gives them, you know, their power, so to speak? And it seems particularly interesting because a lot of these churches have a lot of money thrown around, and who's controlling, you know, what's and where it goes.
Alan Wolfe?
Well, Eddie Gibbs can correct me if I'm wrong here, but there certainly is a tradition in Protestantism that anyone with a mission and anyone with a word who can draw an audience can start a church. There's all kinds of questions, of course, about licensing and so on that will emerge if you actually create an institution. But we have traditions in the United States of storefront preaching, of revival meeting preaching, in which essentially getting the message out comes first and the credentialing comes later. So it's a very different tradition than the Catholic faith, which operates with a totally different approach to a hierarchy and an approach to authority.
Thanks very much for the call, Jeremy.
Thank you.
All right. Let's talk now with Darcy, and Darcy's in Beaufort, South Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Darcy.
Hi. One of your earlier callers was talking about taking her kids to a bunch of different churches and how no one church fit everything that she needed. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like it's a product of our culture that we're looking for a perfect church. We're looking for something that always feels right. And when something happens and all of a sudden this church doesn't feel right, just kind of as a product of our culture, we'll chuck that one and go to another one, be it a more traditional or a less traditional church.
What about that, Eddie Gibbs?
Again, I think you're absolutely right there. Somebody has said if you keep looking and eventually find the perfect church, don't join it, otherwise you'll spoil it.
So we're always looking for new and improved, right?
That's right. I think it's the we've got to redefine what we mean by church. That unfortunately we've turned the word church into a noun when originally really it was a verb. In the New Testament, you didn't go to church, you were the church. I think it's not a case of shopping around, but it's a case of being with others that share your spiritual search and together to seek to know the will of God for our own lives personally and collectively. And as a Christian, I would say guided in that search by the scriptures.
Darcy, thanks very much.
Thank you. Can I say one more thing?
If you keep it short.
Well, I feel like the continuity is important if we're doing this partly for our children, because the continuity is going to help them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Darcy.
Bye-bye.
We're going to continue our conversation when we come back from a short break. We're speaking with Alan Wolfe, director of the Boissy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College, and Eddie Gibbs, a professor of church growth in the School of Intercultural Studies at the Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California. We're also going to find out how the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is working for churches in dealing with gay ministers or clergy. So stay with us if you'd like to join the conversation. It's 800-989-8255 or email TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go back to our guest. Eddie Gibbs is with us. He's professor of church growth in the School of Intercultural Studies at the Fuller Seminary in Pasadena. Also, Alan Wolfe, whose new book is The Transformation of American Religion, How We Actually Live Our Faith. And go back to callers. Terry is on the line with us, and Terry's in Wixom, Michigan.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm a humanist, and I attend a Unitarian Universalist church. I wonder if your guests have had any dealings with that denomination. It's a difficult denomination to market, although the association's been trying to, because, people make jokes about putting question marks on our lawns,
mm-hmm,
and say we don't believe anything, because the church is creedless. It doesn't have a specific set doctrine. But we've been doing things like bumper stickers and billboards to advertise the liberal nature of the faith.
Alan Wolfe?
Oh, I live in a city called Boston, and there's
yes,
a university here. I think it's called Harvard that has certain ties with the Unitarian Universalist Church. So it's a very popular religion in Boston. It is kind of an outlier religion, so to speak, in American Protestantism and American Christianity in particular. But nonetheless, a lot of what is interesting about it, for example, you said that it's creedless. I think you'd be surprised at how many religions in America are either creedless or somewhat suspicious of creeds, or put creeds down on the list compared to other things that they want to emphasize, including the Mormon Church, including the Southern Baptist Convention, quite a few of them, actually.
What about their marketing, though?
What about the marketing? Mm-hmm. I think all churches in the United States are marketing these days. They will market, of course, in different ways and so on. But you've got, if you don't market, you're not going to have too many people in there. And then, you know, what's the point of doing religion if no one's going to listen?
Okay.
There's absolutely no shame in the marketing, I feel.
I agree. a couple of people I quote in my book say, well, they don't know where it's going to stop. They think it'll stop if you do something that violates God, but, you know, there's still pretty big territory before you have to stop.
Well, we have an email. Terry, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
An email on this point from Jake Coughlin in Allegan, Michigan. I was raised Catholic, he writes, and still identify myself as Catholic. I personally have issues with churches advertising with billboards, which I've seen since moving to Southwest Michigan, like businesses. It seems to me that it falls into the category of people praying for wealth and CEOs caught stealing who claim to be good Christians. I think church should modernize in some ways, but should never look at parishioners as dollar signs. Eddie Gibbs?
Oh, well, I agree. The issue for me is in marketing that there are aspects of that are inappropriate because as the Christian church, we are not generating products, we are not creating markets, we're not motivated to make a profit. But on the positive side, that I think we can learn from the business world in terms of awareness. There needs to be an awareness in a world of competing messages. The attraction is also crucial, not to an institution, but from a Christian perspective, to Jesus himself, who said, I came to give life in all its fullness. And also in terms of availability, points of access, we can learn a great deal, I think, from the business world there. And so we have to take the gospel out of so many of our churches, which are maybe fortress-like, certainly in Europe, which is where I'm from. So I see a lot of churches today in coffee shops, in cafes, in homes, in leisure centres, and in Britain, even in pubs. And that's an issue of availability. If that looks extreme today, we need to go back to the first century where the Christian movement owned no real estate.
Eddie Gibbs, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Eddie Gibbs of the Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, who's at the studios of member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. And Alan Wolfe, you've been very good to stay with us throughout the day.
Thanks. It's only a matter of time before some company asks, what would Jesus wear or what would Jesus drink?
Alan Wolfe is director of the Boissy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College, author of The Transformation of American Religion, How We Actually Live Our Faith, and he was with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston.